Welcome to Better Lucky Than Good, a historical miniatures wargaming podcast. I'm Tim Crane, and in this episode, I'm joined by my co-host, Bryce Simon.
Hey, everyone. How are you?
Hey, mate. Now, we're lucky because in this episode, we're going to be joined by a man who has a ridiculous amount of wargaming experience in our hobby, as well as in the wargaming industry. Not only has he been wargaming for some 30-odd years, but also he has owned and operated a retail store, been a wholesaler, cast his own range of miniatures, established his own studio, Siegeworks Studios, as well as written and published two very popular horse and musket rule sets, being Coney Creed and Grand Battles Napoleon. Of course, I'm talking about Andrew Berkmeyer. So good day to everyone, Drew.
Hello, everyone. How are you going? Nice to be on this show with Tim and Bryce. I hope you guys are doing well on this beautiful Friday afternoon.
We certainly are, mate.
It's wonderful afternoon.
It is. It's nice and sunny. It's not too hot. It's not too cold. It's just right, not only for a good old-fashioned podcast, but also just to sit around and have a cup of tea or a beer or whatever you want on a Friday afternoon, which is amazing.
Good old Queensland winters, though.
Beautiful.
Just before we start, Tim, can I just get you to just run through and tell me why you and Bryce started a podcast? What was the thoughts behind it? Sounds like a great idea, and I'm very privileged to be on it. If you could just run me through that before we actually start talking about me.
Yeah, sure, mate. Sure, mate. So it's a good question. But I reckon wargamers, we're almost in a secret society, like an underground society, where we tend to operate in small groups and we don't actually get to meet each other all that often. So Bryce and I wanted to do a podcast to find out more about who wargamers are, how they got into wargaming and what they're playing, and also to discuss a couple of different topics and issues with them. Along the way, we thought we'd do a couple of wargames rules reviews because we found out listen to other podcasts, we quite like that when they do that. And on a personal level, it's actually a great opportunity for me to catch up with people like yourself. Like, you and I have known each other for about 30-odd years, and we just don't talk that much. And along the way, I'll probably make a few new mates, which would be pretty good. What do you reckon, Bryce?
Well, for me, it's always been, the hobby's been quite fragmented with groups all over Australia playing from their garages and from clubs, and it's I think it's a way of bringing everyone together. And, you know, especially we're going to highlight some clubs and talk about what they're playing. And it's always interesting to hear what other people are doing out there.
Yeah, I agree.
So, you know, I think this is a fantastic opportunity to do that.
You go, Drew.
I love that idea. I think it's great. Absolutely great idea. And of course, you're both absolutely right. Australia, people don't realize Australia is the size of Europe, the size of the United States. And as such, it is a vast area with scarcely populated. We've got 25 million people in the whole of this country, and finding people to game with that are relatively close can be difficult. And that's why we have a very high culture of homespun gaming groups, as opposed to really, really heavily into clubs and group scenes in shops, because we're housebound by the distances we come from.
The tyranny of distance.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. That's right. So it's good that you mentioned that, Drew, about wargaming clubs, because Bryce and I are going to interview a few of them, and I think that's going to be quite revealing over the next little while. I think we'll find out quite a lot about what they play, how many members they've got, how long they've been established, how often they operate, what special events they've got coming up, all that type of stuff, you know?
Yes, yes, completely agree. And of course, there's been club changes since about 2009 in the hobby industry in terms of games they play and games that are becoming popular. And then this again has changed. The scene really has changed probably in the last 2 or 3 years to a very, very different idea than the historical and fantasy wargaming it was in the past. And that's going to be very, very interesting. When you talk to all these groups, you start to get an idea of how these radical changes are evolving and how both technology and also culture is changing, and therefore the games we play are also changing. And so that's for a different episode.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I think you got me thinking about that now. So, Drew, could you describe your wargaming background for us?
Yes. Yes, I certainly can. So how did it all begin? I think like most wargamers, it began with Eshi and Airfix boxes back in your local toy store about 35, 40 years ago. And from there, it progressed very, very radically. As soon as you found an actual wargaming club which supported wargames, then from there, it just became all about wargaming. But its roots always start in the Airfix boxes and the Eshi boxes that we are all familiar with as little kids.
And mate, when did you first find your first club, and which club was it, and how did you find it?
Well, I was from Cairns. So Cairns is a very, very small town. It only had about 50,000 people back in the day. And as a result of that, there was no wargaming clubs. There was no hobby stores. There was just your local toy stores. And as a result, there was absolutely nothing in there available on wargaming. I came across my first library book of wargaming when I was about 10 or 11 years old, and it was at the Cairns Library. And I was fascinated by it because, of course, we'd all had these leshy figures. We all sort of made up our own rules about how to play it as opposed to just marbles going pew, pew, pew. And I was one of the ones that certainly put my hand up to being fascinated by writing rules and working out how units worked, even before I even understood how games worked in wargaming. So when I found that first book, and of course a Don Featherstone or Charles Grant book, I can't remember exactly which one it was, but it inspired me. And when my sister came down to Brisbane for a public speaking school event, she went to Napoleon's, which of course is the legendary Tony store. Way, way back in the day, one of the first ones in Brisbane to really support the hobby and do an amazing job of it. And she brought back a bag, 15 mil Napoleonic British minifigs.
Yeah,
and that's where I fell in love with metal miniatures. My first travels to a wargaming store, which again was Napoleon's. This was when I was 15 and we just moved down from Brisbane, from Cairns. And of course, the first thing you buy when, of course, you love Napoleonics, you love history, you go in, you get the bag of Essex 25 mil old guard. And that's my first purchase of wargaming miniatures.
Of course you do. Of course you do.
Yeah. And that's probably not that much longer after I met you, because you were still in high school when I first met you.
I was, yes. Yes. In fact, I think we met when we were 15 and 16 when we played our first game.
Wow.
My memory serves me correctly. Now that's going back about 34 years.
So that's when your Bryce first met, is it? Or is it when you first started wargaming?
Well, I'd started wargaming before then. I'd been able to go to one of the local clubs, and I'd also talked to Stuart Hold and also talked to Tony and Napoleon's, and they had to direct me on a few ways to start gaming. And I'd met them at conventions and the local clubs in Brisbane. I think it was Lordstown North at that stage. And there was also one down on the south side, but I can't remember the name of that. That was mostly just ancients. I think Foggy was very heavily into that at the time. But yes, that was about the time I met Bryce and started gaming. And in fact, he was up in Redcliffe Fair, where I used to bring my second French corps from Udno's corps. Play that against Bryce's Russians.
Yes, you remember correctly.
Well, back in the day, up in Redcliffe Fair. It was great fun.
Real for years are back in those days, mate.
In those days, it was always Empire. The only set of Napoleonic rules that really took off was Empire. So there was Napoleon's battles and a few others, but not many people played anything other than Empire. So in Brisbane, that's what we played. We played Empire, and it became a cult following, especially amongst everyone. Foggy, yourself, Bryce, Stuart, Peter Cross, Mao, everyone played Empire. And that was the culture. That was Napoleonics. That's what you had. And it was great fun in its time.
It's still got a cult following today.
It does have a cult following today, yes. Yes, and it's had a couple of evolutions as well. Still going, which is good to see.
And were you playing anything else back in those days? I mean, once I met you, you were still playing Empire, but you'd moved on to 6mm. Did you play any other games, or did you just move from 15 to 6mm? And why did you move to 6?
Well, I think everyone moved to 6mm because the cheapness. So when you are megalomaniacs like all of us were, you can't just have a couple of divisions of Empire Napoleonic figures. You've got to have corps, and in fact, entire armies. So in those days, one of the players there built up basically the entire French army of 1813. You had people like Bryce building all the Austrians, or Foggy building all the Austrians, or Tim building all the Austrians, and there was all the Russians. I basically built the three armies of the West for 1812. We had all four Prussian corps. It was important to have lots and lots of figures. I don't know why we needed to have so many figures, but we did. And as a result, to get that when you're only young guys, you need to have a budget which can support that. And 6mm gives you that budget, whereas 15, 28 mil, you just can't afford to buy too many figures. But I was playing other things besides Empire. I was playing 10 mil Ancients. Back in the day, there was lots of different ancient rules we played. We played Tactica. We also played WRG. We also played Shock of Impact. They were all fun sets of rules.
Yes.
Occasionally, we also played Ancient Empires too, from memory.
I think Bryce used to play WRG, and I used to play Shock of Impact.
I played in competitions with WRG.
Do you ever play any comps, Drew, back in the day?
No, I was never really a comp player. I never found a passion for comps. I think my sense of wanting to refight battles was more fascinating to me than challenge the minds and army lists of another person. Since then, of course, I've developed with Cody Krieg and Grant Baz Napoleon a point system and a competition system, and have actually run quite a few tournaments. So, and I quite enjoy the tournament scene now. But in the day, I was very much more interested in how did the battles work? Who won? Why did they win? Was it to do with the armies? Was it to do with the generals? Was it sheer fate? Or was it weather? You know, all those sorts of things fascinated me. So I pursued more the historical battles approach.
I saw, Drew, that you'd set up, and I thought this was fascinating, a world ranking for Conan Krieg for a while ago. I don't think that's still running anymore, but I thought that was fascinating.
It is world ranking because, of course, we had people from Britain, we had people from Italy, we had people from Spain. Americans tended to play more the club scene as opposed to when it came to the tournament side of it, and that was okay. But we literally had everyone from Europe all the way across to Australia, all playing competition games. And for the 3 or 4 years I ran that personally, it was lots and lots of fun, and it's fascinating to see what armies people play and the results to which they get as well, which, of course, something we can talk about later on is that whole idea of how interesting developing lists is.
Yeah. And so, mate, what are you playing these days?
These days, I'm very much restricted to time, too much time for me to actually play any games. And when I do, I like to play my favorites, which, of course, is probably a little bit biased, but it's Grand Battles Napoleon and Conan Krieg. And the eras of Conan Krieg that I play now is Frederick, the Age of Frederick, which is your 1730 to 1719. Then you've also got Gerda Roy, which is 1660 through to 1730. And also like the Rise of Nations, so the idea of your Franco-Prussian, Crimea, and also your freedom rules, which is your Mexican-American wars, which I've really loved. I played quite a few games with that and developed that quite heavily. And of course, your American Civil War, which of course, right beside me, though you can't see it right now, I've actually started to get back into painting. I stopped painting for about 10 years there. I've got back in and I have a set of Perry ACW cavalry box on my painting table there with 12 troopers and 12 horses ready to go. And I think it can make them... Well, I think they just got to be Virginia boys, Confederate Virginia boys. So that's what we're going to be doing over the next week or so, paint.
So that'd be 28 mil, I take it, given their Perrys.
It is 28 mil. Yeah. So I've painted up a box that are 28 mil Perry infantry, and again, Confederates, and I'm basing it around Jewett's division with the brigade, which has the Marylanders in it, and then there's the Virginians and North Carolinians. And they're the guys that stormed up, I think it was a little round top, successfully, of course, but came close. They got over the first line of defenses and then were thrust back by the Northern troops reserves. So that's the area where I'm building my division from. And that'll be for Conan Krieg.
Wow.
You mentioned quite a few different eras there. So have you developed the Conan Krieg rules a bit more of the background to handle those different eras?
I have, yes. So when I launched version 4, Horse and Musket, it is literally horse and musket, the entire era. And a lot of playtesting was done around not just the 7 Years' War, which was pretty much how the original one back in the 1970s was written, just dealing directly with French Indian Wars and Frederick the Great Wars. And since then, when I took it over, I bought it out in what was that? About 2006, 2007, I bought out Conan Krieg. And so then went through and did a lot of playtesting. About 2 years it took me. Rewriting based on developing it as a points-based game and bringing it into basically the modern era. And as a result of that, we had version 3 and then version 4, which is now everything. So I have army lists for the Franco-Prussians, for Crimea, for the American War of Independence, for ACW, and of course the Mexican-American War, which is one of my favorites because it has all the bright blue uniforms for the Americans. Of course, all these crazy sort of Napoleonic looking uniforms for the Mexican army. So I've built up that side, both sides for that, and I've fought many, many battles for that. And the Conan Krieg rules work really, really well for it. It's lots and lots of fun. But it also goes back to basically 1660. Pretty much when it was no longer basically sword and spear, thrusting pikes at each other, the evolution of the Dutch firing system, platoon firing, is when we start Conan Krieg and obviously the decline of the pike. It's something that a lot of people, they still think of Conan Krieg as only the Frederick Great Era.
Yeah,
and there is so much more. I mean, mechanics are very, very flexible. They're very, very fluid. Your army list development is what creates the character and the flavor of the eras. The mechanics are basically the same. You move, you shoot, got initiative, got army morale, and that's pretty basic in its simplicity, but the difficulty and the flavor and the fluff comes in how you develop and control the army point system, the purchasing system, and the types of troops and how they operate within each era and within each nation, in fact, as well. The character of them is all different, and that changes. So one minute you might have, I'm also working on lots of the Indians, the Ottomans, and not just the Ottomans. So I'm doing a lot of research in not just a standard Ottoman list, which is what I brought out in version 3 Koenig Krieg, but the variations of the Ottoman armies, because of course, in name only, most of the Ottoman Empire was Ottoman. So you had things like the various bays of North Africa, such as Morocco, Algiers, Tunis. Yes. They had their own armies and their own identity. And half the time, they basically just snubbed the Sultan and said, get lost. Same as the Egyptian Ayyubids, the Wahhabites that became Saudi Arabia now. They're all part of that same interesting convoluted Ottoman Empire.
Yeah.
And so I'm actually working on lots of lists from the Balkans, the Khanate states, all the way through to the bays of North Africa, such as Morocco, and how the units work, how they don't work. And that's just for the Ottomans. There's also the various spice, such as the Thais, the Philippines, the Vietnamese. And then you've got your saffron states, such as the Mughals, the Hindus, the Afghans. Then you've got your Persians on top of that as well. So I'm looking at an entire worldwide, and it's going to take a while because, quite frankly, to be honest, I just have not had very much time in the last couple of years to develop those into published lists. But I'm hoping to continue working on them and fulfill my obligations, which I have set out, and my goals, which is to allow people to gain not just European-centered battles, but across the world.
Well, that's hilarious. One of the questions I often ask people is, are they more like a war gamer or a painter or a historian or a collector? You know, like there's various different ways war gamers describe themselves. But it sounds like you've gone pretty heavily into the old history side of things now.
I never call myself a true historian. I'm an amateur historian. I decided not to go ahead and become a historian when I was at university. I started doing honours in classical history with a thesis on Alexander the Great. And then the call of the nightclubs and traveling, working in bars became much more interesting. So since then, I have only ever been an amateur historian, but my love of history has continued all the way through my life. And it's not just European centric history, it's world history. And it's fascinating because how people operate, how they do logistics, how economics and how culture and beliefs and the military style and theories and philosophies that surround the person, the nation, the ethnic groups, and how that comes into play with how they actually conduct war is fascinating and very, very different. Not always the same at all.
No, I agree. It's really interesting, isn't it? When you look at, for instance, the French Revolution and just how dramatically that affects the French army compared to the other nations, the whole idea of meritocracy, it's a massive impact in that era. And that's just a very common example. What do you reckon, Bryce?
Yeah, look, I'm just amazed because you're touching on a lot of theatres that people would never even consider gaming. So, you know, when you talk about spice armies and stuff like that, they're very rarely seen on the table anywhere. And I'm sure miniatures can be a real pain to get a hold of for those sorts of armies, to get the right miniatures.
That is absolutely true, Bryce. And it's one of the reasons why I've also been loath, because I also like to have some nice painted models to release as part of the pictures for the books or the PDFs that I produce. And you're right, over the last 10 years, a lot of those areas that I've explored have not had a great deal of supporting interest. But that's not quite true of today. So everything from War Games Atlantic all the way through to your smaller scales are starting to produce Afghans, Persians, Eastern-style armies and ethnic groups. And there's even articles in the War Games magazines about Russian indigenous peoples. They're all showing how you can do it, how you can convert miniatures. And there is starting to become a much more global interest in the various wars. And also the manufacturers are beginning to move with those times. And I think also the fact that you have the changes in technology has also made that much more possible. And I think as we move closer and closer towards AI, and also just the fact that you can do so much with computer generation, that's the types of figures that are coming out are rapidly going to become more interesting as opposed to just the same.
And 3D printers are just enablers now to reach those periods quite easily. As long as you've got someone who's got the abilities to make the 3D, then you can just print off an army so easily and cheaply now.
Absolutely. And of course, that's one of the most wonderful things about the modern era is the 3D printer and how that's going to change wargaming and how it's going to change the building of miniatures and what types of miniatures people can now have access to. And I think that's a very, very exciting thing for the future of wargaming.
Another thing to put onto what you've said earlier as well is the wargaming is spreading further and further around the world as people are traveling. I came across wargamers in Thailand. You would have never heard of wargamers in Thailand beforehand, but now they're actually starting to build gaming clubs in Thailand and in other Asian countries that would have never taken that on. And they're more likely to look at their own indigenous history for scenarios or theatres of war to wargame themselves.
It's funny you should say that because, of course, my wife being Thai, I've gone to Thailand quite a few times with her and visited family. And there is a shop in Bangkok, which is a wargame/board game shop. I actually think on my don't know whether it's the Siege Works or the Grand Battles Facebook page, but I actually did a live walk around when I was actually there in Bangkok about 2 years ago. And I think there is also now, I was just seeing that there is a board game that's been brought out about the Royal Thai Army and the battles of Thailand between 1500 and 1700. Something. I think it's some Ayutthaya, the Ayutthaya Empire, somewhere around that area anyway. But between 1500 and 1700, there's a board game out. And I think it's being created by either somebody in Thailand or somebody who lives in Thailand. It's quite amazing.
Wow.
But you're absolutely right. I mean, there is also a lot more exploration by the Poles, the Ukrainians, the Russians, the Eastern states who are now creating interesting war games, interesting miniatures, because they're not Western Eurocentric. And the same within Thailand. The more you start developing that wargaming culture, of course, they're all still very much financially poor. They don't have huge incomes, but that's changing in Thailand. But as they get more disposable income, you'll see a lot more Thai people going, well, you know what, let's do stuff about our own history. Let's build armies for ourselves. And I think you're absolutely right. It's going to happen very, very soon. And it's going to be very exciting to see it.
I think there's a lot of, and I'm going to blame the English for this, a lot of English expats that have moved over there for their retirement and are wargaming in their basements there. So,
because it's so cheap, because you can get a meal for like $1 or $2 at a local village.
Yeah.
And it's a lovely place to retire. And the wargaming scene over there is growing and growing. So I've teed up the next time I go over for a game, 7 years walk. Not my set of rules, but, you know, I'll play another set of rules. I think they play Black Powder over there just to meet up and have international war games.
Yeah, nice.
So, Drew, who are you playing with these days, mate?
As I said before, I'm very time poor, so I don't get much time to game at all. Mm-hmm. I would say that I game mostly with Foggy way back in the past. You all know Foggy. He's a wonderful painter and a great gaming companion. And we play Great Battles of Napoleon and a little bit of Koenigkrieg. Played two games with Foggy over the last 2 years. And just recently I caught up with Mal again. So Mal has this wonderful war game shed. It's about 8x11. And he does a lot of Black Powder, Longstreet, and variations of the much faster play games. Because his focus is not so much on the war game, but on the campaign side of things. So I've had a chance to roll some dice. And his YouTube channel is at Malcolm Gray. And he's doing a fair bit right now on the American Civil War. And I've had a few American Civil War games. And I think they ran through just recently over a weekend, the entire Waterloo campaign. Played about 7 battles with an outcome of a French victory, I think.
Well,
so right. You know, I'd like to ask that question, who people are playing with and also how often they're playing, because I find the answers are quite broad. Like some people play once or twice a month, some people not even that much, and then others you find out they're playing twice a week. And it's quite interesting to see that variation.
I think we all go through stages of gaming. So when I ran the shop and also when I ran the Siegeworks Studios, I was hosting games 2-3 times a week. When I ran the shop at Dragonfire Games, of course, you would be playing demo games or playing games every day.
Yeah. So, mate, turning to your industry side, when did you first become interested in kind of getting into the industry rather than just being a player, and why?
Excellent question. I believe that I was sitting down chatting to Mum in the lounge room when I was about 20, 21 years old.
Yeah, right.
And I stated back then, I would like to own my own war game shop. It's going to be called Dragonfly Games, and I'm going to run war games. And then about 2 or 3 years later, you and I are actually renting and just looking more closely at it, because Pendragon was starting to take off, and it was the gaming scale that I really loved. And I was thinking about having a chat, make a proposal to Leon at Pendragon about retailing his products here in Australia.
Yeah.
I remember having a conversation with you at the time, and it made me sort of realize that I wasn't quite ready yet. Yeah. And the questions you basically stated were, how many packets do you need to sell in order to make profit? And how do you compare that with your costs?
Yeah.
And it made me realize that perhaps I need some life experience before I just jump into a business, never having run a business before.
How business-like of you, Tim?
Yeah, mate, it's the old banker coming out of me. Yeah.
He was just a bank joining at the time studying. I think you were still studying then too, weren't you?
Yeah, studying commerce, yeah.
So it was, you stopped me, Tim. You were the one that stopped me.
I stopped. Well, I delayed you because you did actually.
You delayed me, that's right. And it was good, because when I actually launched into it in 2003, I registered my sole trader company, Dragonfly Games, and that's developed into a bricks and mortar store between 2005 and 2008. And I started getting pretty sick in 2008, and I had to basically close everything down for a little while. I ran everything online until about 2014, but that was basically the end of my retailing. I needed to get better. And that was probably a result of the fact is that I had spent many years working in nightclubs and I hadn't quite finished with the lifestyle.
That's quite a shame, because that was almost an institution, that shop. Like, a lot of people used to meet there quite regularly. Yeah, it was a pretty big thing back in the day.
It was a very, very big thing. And of course, I was very, very happy with the fact that we were one of the leaders in Flames of War sales, and also doing very, very well with our Games Workshop as well, Australia-wide. So it was good, lots of fun, but physically I was not up to the task for too long.
Where was that located?
That was located down the south side in Browns Plains.
Yeah,
and we used to have people drive from the sunny coast past all the game shops to come to us, and people drive from the Gold Coast to come to us. And they loved it. And I think one of the key reasons why people love it is A, customer service. B, we had a lot of gaming space for a humble hobby store. And we encouraged lots of gaming at nighttime and on weekends as well. And had a lot of supporting staff who were knowledgeable in all the various areas so that they could provide the right service to those people. And lastly, and very, very importantly, I stocked a lot of goods on the shelf. And a lot of games companies don't tend to stock what people want. And I realized very, very early on that to make it work, impulse buying was the way, because of course back then online shopping was only just starting to take off. It wasn't really something that people were doing. So you had to make sure that people bought. And if you had the latest thing come in from the latest release every time and you had enough of each, then people would walk in and buy it straight, put $50 on downloads, and then they buy it. So yeah. The key to a retail store back in that day, and that was quite successful in a humble way. I was never going to make a fortune out of it, but I don't think most people create gaming stores for that anyway. I think they just go to enjoy the lifestyle and to make a living. But it was still quite successful. And one of the key results was because you've got to put money in to make money. And I had a lot of stock on the shelf all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes sense, because the amount of times that I've ever gone to game store, I always want to buy something, you know, and if you got something that's attractive, you take it, you buy it off the shelf.
One of the things that I noticed as well, and I think it's going on again today, because there's a changing climate, what people want to buy. No one really knows whether it's all the gimmicky stuff or whether it's the old faithfuls. And one of the things I realized is that your old faithfuls, which is always your Games Workshop, your Magic Gathering and all these, their margins, especially when you give discounts and club discounts, your margins are actually quite small. It's around about 30%, which is not a great deal. You've got to do a lot of turnover to make that work. So, and one of the things I noticed about game stores before I started my own was that a lot of them would try and supplement by high margin products, but products no one wanted. So they kind of just stood on the shelf. And of course, to make a business work, you need to have high turnover of stock, no matter whether it's margin great or margin poor. margin call, the more you need to turn over.
Yeah.
But so I've never been a great fan of Games Workshop. Very, very clever company, but not my thing. But that was my bread and butter. That paid the rents, that paid the wages. And so I stopped all of it, kept up the weekly releases, and that was the main focus. And that's one of the keys. But then after that, because the margins aren't great, I looked at the various margins, how to improve margins. And oddly enough, food and drinks is a great way to improve margins. Probably not so good for people's health, but an excellent way to improve margins. And the other thing is a lot of the historical miniatures, though not as popular, they have better margins. And so I started shopping around for various historical miniatures and companies which produce to very, very good margins. And that's how I increased the margins from around about 30, 31% up to about 35%+ when I closed the store.
Really? And you did a bit of wholesaling there for a while? Was that a result of...
I did, yes.
Was that a result
of... That was a result of Anton Ducrot. So Anton Ducrot had a company called Flashpoint Miniatures.
Sure.
He loves Vietnam and moderns, and he's always been interested in that. And I think I was the only Australian to talk to him about selling his miniatures ranges in Australia. And so I stocked a fair few and was quite successful, marginally successful, considering its type of theme is just moderns, effectively. And then about 2009, he was getting tired of producing and running his own wholesale business. So he asked if I wanted to buy it because I'd built up a good connection, good rapport with Anton. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, sure. I didn't have a spin casting machine at that stage and I didn't know anything about Vietnam. So I asked a guy named Ken Cole to help me with it. And so he came along as well. And we started wholesaling Flashpoint miniatures through Siegeworks Studios, which is my company, and started redeveloping a set of Flashpoint Vietnam rules and moderns rules. And we were selling to shops around the world, Germany, Britain, and America, as well as in Australia.
And is that why you...
That was a lot of fun.
Is that why in the end you started manufacturing your own miniatures as well? Because I remember you used to...
I did, yes. I started going through a process of making my own. So I started with a number of niche areas. I did the very, very basic infantry for the command figures and the marching pose or two marching poses for the main protagonists in the Seven Years' War in 15 mil. I was getting into the good old sci-fi. So I had some 20 mil sci-fi miniatures, which I was making, and I was going to create a world for it. It fizzled and I went, it's too much doing everything. And I really wanted to focus on the history, just the history that I loved.
Yeah.
So in the end, I went, you know what? Vietnam, great. We added a huge amount of other ranges to it. So there was a lot more stuff than we started off. And it was fun making it, fun creating it, fun getting sculptors to sculpt it and go through the process of getting your molds made and getting contractors to your spinning and working on how that works and buying your blister packaging and your designing of your miniatures and your backboards for your miniature blisters and so on and so forth. All great fun. But in the end, I just went, that's not where I want to be. So I sold that on in, I think, 2015 or 16.
Yeah, right. Because,
Vietnam I sold on. Sorry, but no, it was about 2012 I sold the Vietnam on. And then in about 2015, I sold to Dave from Caliber Books the various miniature ranges, except for the Hanoverian, which was something I sold to Eagle Miniatures later.
And mate, rules writing. So how did you get into that and why? Like, tell us a bit about that. You told us a little bit about the back part of County Creek and what you're working on now. But how did you kind of get into it at the start? What made you want to do it?
Well, I've always been interested in writing. I mean, obviously, when you go to university and you study history and ancient history, writing is part of what you do. And although it's a very, very different discipline, writing academically, than it is writing fluff and flavor, the discipline of actually sitting down and writing is something that stays with you and is always something that you want to do in one form or another. I didn't want to do academic. I didn't like the idea of having to quote and ponder through every rustic tome there was and then spend my life discussing minor points about something for the sake of it and writing 100 pages about it.
Mm-hmm.
I did enjoy in third year at university, I did a paper on Napoleon, 1812. And was it political or was it military reasons why he continued the campaign, started the campaign and continued it? And I got a sentence for that, and I asked to actually do honors in that area. But unfortunately, the lecturer didn't know enough of Napoleonic areas to continue with that. So I went with the classical history instead. But anyway, the point is, though, is that history and writing are two things that I love. And it was just a natural transition to want to write war games rule sets and the fluff and flavor that goes with it.
So one distinct memory I have of you when you were a lot younger, Drew, was when you were doing your grade 12 hex, I think we all had to write an essay in as part of getting our hex score or a TE score back then. And I believe you wrote about the crossing of the Brazilian River and the charge of the Baden Hussars, if I remember correctly.
You have a much better memory than me. I don't remember anything of year 12 outside of finishing. And instead of everyone else went out and got drunk at schoolies, I spent that week cutting cane till the hands bled, burning a living. So it's the only thing I really remember of year 12.
It was just so distinctly, I remember after, because I think I finished grade 12 maybe a year or two before you. And then I said, oh, how did you go? Because you have to write an essay is one of the last things you do, one of the last exams you do. And they give you a little bits of prods of what you can write about, but basically you can write about anything. And I asked you, and it was distinct in my head. I wish I was as clever as you and wrote about an incident in the Napoleonic Wars, which I was so keen as you were back then. But yeah, just stuck in my head.
It's interesting you say that, not so much about me being clever than you, because that's not the case at all. No one's really actually clever than anyone else. They just have developed different skill sets through advantages or disadvantages. But when it comes to Napoleonics, that's one of the things that is sadly missing, this idea of history. Now, you loved history. I love history. I just feel that history is not being taught anymore. And as someone who's been in education for quite a few years now, on the non-teaching side of it, I see this as a real shame. And that's another reason why I wanted to actually write war games rules. It's because I was in the shop at the time dealing with a lot of kids as well as adults, and they're all playing Games Workshop. And I'm just shaking my head going, outside of a very tenuous homage to medieval Catholicism and the Holy Roman Empire, there is nothing in Games Workshop which is going to cultivate and develop that sense of history, that love of learning, that idea of the past and how we connect to it. And it's one of the reasons as well why I started writing historical rules, is because I wanted to be able to see other generations than myself also appreciate history.
Yeah.
So, mate, you bought Coney Cree and then you went about and rewrote it into a new edition. How did you find that process? Because I know it was quite onerous, wasn't it?
This is the thing. If you can do that full time and earn a living, as of course most writers do not get the chance to actually write full time. There are very, very few. But if you ever get the chance to actually sit down and write full time, it is a wonderful experience. Because firstly, if you do it thoroughly, because when you start developing point systems and you want to have tournaments, those other areas. And I said before the last talkie about the concept of, I'm not really into the challenge the person next to you idea. With developing a list, but more about how historically battles occurred. However, all my friends, well, actually a lot of my friends like yourself and many others, are keen, dead set, in love with tournament gaming. And there are skill sets you have to develop in order to successfully tournament game. So what I had to do is I had to, A, make sure that the philosophies behind writing the rules and the point systems were such that you could play tournaments fairly and effectively, and all those things that people love, such as ripping apart and cutting the fat off and just making sure that they have every sort of element fixed in place so that each part works in unison with each other, or using a mathematical formula. I know Bill Davis used to use this where it was length versus effect. So he built this Spanish list for Coney Cree, and it wasn't amazing. What it was it was so long that it overlapped every other person's flanks. And so he knew that he would be hitting people's flanks all the time and exposing them to pressure every time. So his was based on a mathematical formula of frontage versus effect, as in your morale classes and your ability to push hard and shoot well. So these are all things that you have to combine and be able to balance. And that was a fantastic intellectual exercise in itself. But the idea of writing, of reading and absorbing all the history surrounding it, and of course, you have to playtest games all the time. So what I did was I just playtested. For 2 years there, I would just keep running games for people all the time, playing games, going, oh, that doesn't work, that works, until I was satisfied that it worked for me and I was going to enjoy the game.
Mm.
Yeah, so it's a wonderful process. I really loved it. Yes, it is onerous. Yes, it does take a long time. And you do sometimes struggle with how you're going to concisely and effectively send everything and make everything clear for everyone to understand. And, you know, everyone has different ideas about how you write a war game set of rules, mm-hmm. what you put in, what you don't put in. And it's just fascinating. I love it. Yeah, it's good fun.
Yeah, there's a lot of names in the beginning of that Carney Cree book of people that contributed either through writing or editing or photos or miniatures or so on and so forth. So you had, I think you mentioned about 20 or 30 people in the front of that book.
Wargaming is like a village. It takes an entire village, or in this case, it takes an entire community to create a game.
Mm.
And that's sort of manipulated cliche is true of wargaming and wargames rules and writing wargames rules. It takes a community to play games.
Great.
A lot of people involved, in the painting, the editing, the photocopying, the playtesting, the design of the tabletops, everything. And I've had it any other way.
And you need,
because I was in the gaming industry and had my own shop, that I knew a lot of people.
You know, and it's always helpful to have people's different points of view on games, and just adds to your strengths. If you know the right people for the right situations, you can talk to certain people about certain armies because they know a bit more about things, and you can leverage their knowledge. It's, you're right about that. It takes a war games village to grow up a child.
It certainly does. And one of the things as well is that as a general point of, for anyone out there who wants to write their own set of rules, is not everyone's going to enjoy your set of rules. You will have people who will be fanatics for life, who will just rave about it. It's the most amazing thing since sliced bread. And you'll have us just go, yeah, build my thing. And the important thing is to appreciate the fact that we all walk different paths in our wargaming lives, and that you just don't get worried about the fact of knowing that there's, you know, that there may not be people that like your set of rules or make their comments about it. Don't take it to heart, because we're all wargamers. We have different ways and interests and what we want out of a game. And if you enjoy the game that you have written, then others will enjoy it who are like you. And if you want to, and if that's, you're happy with that and happy publishing it, and you're happy seeing it out there in the world, and you really get a warm, fuzzy glow when you hear people across the world send you emails saying, I love what you're doing, and then have a chat to you about it. To me, that's a reward in itself, and I really enjoy that.
So you've done two sets of rules so far, Carney Cree and Grand Battles Napoleon. Are you thinking about writing a third set of rules?
Yes. Yes, the short answer is yes. Ancients to Medieval.
Nice.
Is based around a format. I originally wrote it not so much on a Carney Cree model, but the mechanics of Carney Cree in themselves, as in action is to move, to shoot, to charge, the mechanics of army morale, the mechanics of brigade or divisional, or basically maneuver elements, which are made up of all of these units which are running around the field doing X, Y, and Z. The mechanics are still the same, and the mechanics are the same any period you have. So it can transfer across. It needs massaging, and that's what I've been doing with it, and it will definitely change. It will not be Carney Cree, but I started off with a set of rules which has actually devolved back to Carney Cree. The set of rules was an ancient set of rules, and it was based differently, had different concepts behind it, and now it's moving back towards Carney Cree. So yes, I am thinking about doing a set of rules which I've been playing with as an intellectual exercise.
Yep.
for ancients all the way through to your basically Renaissance, you know, around about 1600.
Yeah.
That'd be great. That'd be really interesting to see, but, you know, when you get going with that.
Well, I've just got to be fair to my current Grand Battles and Trinity Creek bases, which Grand Battles is hanging out for all of your German lists, your Republican lists, your Italian lists. So I've got to, just in Grand Battles alone, I've got about three or four books worth to be released, to be fair to them.
Yeah, right.
So the Ancients, what I'm trying to say is, yes, the Ancients is something I'm playing with, but it's not something that I'll release in the near future.
Sure.
Oh, I can't wait for the new books, Drew.
They'll mostly come out as PDFs to start with, because the more time I have to take to write an entire book means the longer it is for people just to go, I just wanted one list. So just like the Poles, I'll be releasing the Bavarians, the Saxons, and the Ottomans as single PDF copies to begin with. And I'll just do that as I go through, because at this stage, I just don't have the time to create an entire book. So they will be coming up, and looking, you know, the Bavarians is almost done. And I'll actually get you guys to go through when I'm ready and do some editing if you want to. And that's almost ready to go. And then the Saxons is next.
Yeah, love to help.
Yeah, that'd be good. And mate, self-publishing. So, you know, you didn't go down the route of actually writing your books and getting someone else to publish them. You published them yourself. And I noticed recently, I believe you can get your books on Amazon now as well. Is that right?
Back in 2015, you could definitely still get your books on Amazon.
Right.
I chose not to go down that line. When I first created Conan Krieger, we released it to the True Siegeworks Studios, and we released it to shops that wanted to support around the world.
Yep.
So it wasn't a print-on-demand, and it wasn't other companies doing the selling for us on their behalf either, unless they were retailers who sell books in their shops. Then, of course, I went through and reissued or redeveloped Conan Krieg into version 4 and Grand Battles, and I released those as print-on-demand to start with, and then had a chat to the guys at North Star, and they decided they loved the books and they wanted to take them on. So they took them on for a while there, international, and then brought them back in-house, and I've just been selling them through the Siegeworks website. But just recently, I've been looking at other ways that are less demanding on my time. And so I'm looking directly through Lulu, through Amazon, through, I think, Barnes & Noble. There's a few other shops there that do the online selling for you. And all you do is you just check out your sales at the end of each month, process the money into your account, and it's pretty well done for you. You don't have to worry about anything else.
Wow.
How? Yep. Because that takes less time than actually going through the orders on your own website, getting them printed by your print company that you're using, telling everyone about it, and then having them distributed and make sure they get there to the place, which actually works quite well. It usually takes about 2 weeks after they're printed to get to anywhere in the world, which is excellent by anyone's standards. But it's still, you know, demanding making sure you're following up on every single book, where it's going and where it's, you know, and they're traveling and checking it and tracking and all that sort of stuff. So this is much, much easier way of doing it. It's literally tick and flick.
So you never did a big initial print run. You've always done print on demand, have you?
No, I've done two sets. So when I first published Conan Krieg version 3, we printed a lot of books, and then we sold them from the company to individuals or to retailers around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And we did the same thing again with Grand Battles, where we released the books through North Star.
Yeah, okay. But you find the print on demand.
Global sales around the world.
But you find the print on demand now just
works.
They didn't
do print on demand. No, they published through an Eastern European company.
No, but you find the print on demand now a bit easier, do you, compared to a big
print? I do, yes. Much, much easier. Your exposure isn't the same. So if you really want to make it an actual business you're trying to live off of, you'd obviously want to have more advertising. You want to be advertising more with your social media. You'd want to emphasize more with the various magazines. War game magazines are out there as well. You'd be a lot more active in the social networking community. But I do find that your margins are better if you print yourself. And of course, depending on how much money you want to make out of it and how competitive you want your products to be, defines how many you sell through these massive online sellers such as Amazon.
Yeah.
Because, of course, they take quite a big cut from your bottom dollar.
Yeah, I'm sure. So I think we're getting towards the end of this. Bros, do you have any other questions? Or Andrew, do you have anything else you want to talk a bit about? Bros?
So, Drew, is there anything that stands out to you as like something that you are really glad you've done or that you're most proud of?
I think I'm happy having ticked a number of boxes. The first one is having run a marginally successful war games business, as in the retail store, Dragonfly Games. That's a tick box. Most war gamers go, I really like to run a war game store of my own. That was really, really good. I think being able to write and publish your own books has been most enjoyable exercise. And even though I feel guilty about not being able to oblige the base of wonderful supporters of these games as much as I'd like, at this, I still get a lot of satisfaction out of the fact is that they love the game. They enjoy playing historical games as opposed to hysterical games. That to me is a great source of satisfaction, knowing that just like when you cook a good meal and everyone's sitting around the table eating and we're all having a great time enjoying it, the idea of watching people play games that you've had a hand in is a real honor and a real satisfaction. So I'd say that being able to write games for people and also to serve them in a community of gamers has been good.
Hear, hear. I really need to thank you for your contribution to miniature wargaming in general, Drew. You've helped me more than what you actually think you have. Like catching up with you again a few years ago and introducing me to this bunch of rabble has really brought my passion for wargaming back again, because as you mentioned earlier, it's a life experience. You go through highs and lows with groups of people, and you maybe even change players that you play with regularly. But I got myself a really good crowd now that I play with, and it's all because we all knew you somehow, Drew.
That's really nice. Thank you, Bryce. And you can't say more about wargaming is what do you get out of it? And for a lot of us, it's that sense of community, that sense in which we fit in somewhere where we can be ourselves, we can express ourselves in ways that others also express themselves. That is historical war game, specifically Napoleonics, but also in other areas. And we get to do it with people who love the same things we do. And when you meet a great bunch of guys and you're all interested in the same thing and you're all enjoying a good game, that's a great way to spend some free time when you're not spending it with family.
Well, we're certainly going to invite you up here for a game or two, Drew, if we can ever drag you away from family and friends.
I would love that. That sounds like a great plan.
And so, fellas, I think this pretty much brings us to the end of the episode. But just remember, the harder the conflict, the more glorious the victory. Have you got any final words?
I do. I do indeed. Happy gaming to one and all. Enjoy, and thank you for this interview. It's been a great fun. It's been nice to catch up, and also great to share my experiences and let others know a bit about myself and about the games and the fact that you've made that happen. I am deeply honored and thankful for that.
And thanks, guys. I always say, rock on, everyone, and we'll talk again soon.